This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation, please visit our website at zmm.mro.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
Blue Cliff Record, case 89. The hands and eyes of the Bodhisattva of great compassion. A pointer. If your whole body were an eye, you still wouldn't be able to see it. If your whole body were an ear, you still wouldn't be able to hear it. If your whole body were a mouth, you still wouldn't be able to speak of it. If your whole body were mind, you still wouldn't be able to perceive it. Now, leaving aside whole body for the moment, if suddenly you had no eyes, how would you see? Without ears, how would you hear? Without a mouth, how would you speak? And without a mind, how could you perceive? Here, if you can unfurl a single pathway, then you'll be a fellow student with the ancient Buddhas. But leaving aside studying for the moment, under whom would you study? The main case. Yunyan asked Dao Wu, what does a Bodhisattva of great compassion use so many hands and eyes for? And Dao Wu said, it's like someone reaching back, groping for a pillow in the middle of the night. Yunyan said, I understand. And Dao Wu said, how do you understand it? Yunyan said, all over the body are hands and eyes. Dao Wu said, you said quite a bit, but you've only said 80%. Yunyan said, how would you say it, elder brother? Dao Wu said, throughout the body are hands and eyes. The verse, all over the body is right, throughout the body is right. Bringing it up is still 100,000 miles away. Spreading its wings, the rock soars over the clouds of the six compounds. It propels the wind to beat against the waters of the four oceans. What speck of dust suddenly arises? What wisp of hair hasn't stopped? You don't see? The net of jewels hanging down in patterns, reflections upon reflections. Where do the hands and eyes on the staff come from? Bah. So this weekend we did a retreat on compassion, on the precepts and the paramitas of the Bodhisattva. So we were exploring the Bodhisattva path, the vows of the Bodhisattva, and the nature of compassion itself. And I, at the very beginning, spoke about how we, in practicing the Buddha Dharma, we've adopted the language. Some of the language we adopt has come to us from, its original Sanskrit, or and so we have to learn what those terms mean in terms of Buddhism. But other aspects of the Buddha Dharma have been translated, like compassion. And so compassion already has a meaning in English. And so that's why it's being used, because it is the closest sort of way of communicating what is meant by karuna. But we also need to go further and understand, but what does that mean in Buddha Dharma? As practitioners, as the teachings are put it forth, what is meant by compassion? How are we to understand that? And so we spent the weekend looking at that in terms of sort of the basic teachings, sort of the underpinnings of what compassion is based in, because ultimately it's, and in every moment, it's the wisdom of selflessness, of non-duality made manifest in activity, but activity that is directly and effectively, skillfully, alleviating suffering. And so this great vow of the Bodhisattva is to alleviate suffering of all beings, wishing in gladness and in safety that may all beings be at ease. And so this is a deep, heartfelt wish. It's not a casual thing. It's not a distant thing. And it's not a thing that is wished for and then forgotten. And so in that moment, it's uttering something that we're working towards, we're practicing to make the very substance of our being. that we see our lives as this. We see our lives not as just vehicles to, you know, get into trouble or get out of trouble, but to be a benefit in the world. That's what we're here for. And that if we really study that, if we practice that, then all the good that we seek, we will find. We will find in accord with our karma. That doesn't mean we'll find all that we want. Wishing in gladness and in safety. Gladness here is your happiness is my joy. Your good fortune is my contentment. Your good qualities are my inspiration. Your success is my satisfaction. That because of you, I am. And so Union and Daowu are Dharma brothers. They both studied with the same master, Yaoshen. This is 9th century China. And so they're brothers having this conversation. They're siblings. So what does Avalokiteshvara, this great bodhisattva of compassion, use all these hands and eyes? So some of the images of Avalokiteshvara, Kanon, Kuan Yin, Chen Rezig, sometimes the depiction is of the bodhisattva of compassion with many hands and eyes. Many hands, arms and hands, and sometimes within each, the palm of each hand is an eye. Sometimes there are implements in the hands, which are the implements by which she manifests her compassion. And so he's asking, what does she use all these hands and eyes for? What is compassion? How does it function? How does it practice? What is its root? How do we awaken it? Master Dogen said in his fascicle on Kanon, said the bodhisattva of great compassion is Avalokiteshvara, the one who perceives the cries of the world. That's what Avalokiteshvara means. She is also called one who has complete freedom in perceiving. This bodhisattva is regarded as the mother and father of all Buddhas. Do not assume that this bodhisattva has not mastered the way as much as Buddhas. So what he's saying there, in essence, is that compassion and wisdom are one reality. They're non-dual. And that to practice, realize, manifest, accomplish great compassion is equal to practicing, realizing, manifesting wisdom. They're one path. And it's our nature, right? Every religion has to deal with this issue of like, so, you know, what's the stuff that we're made of, and how do we account for what goes on in the world? How do we account for what we do? Particularly all the negative things that we do. So does that mean that's our basic nature? Is, you know, just to hurt, to create chaos and confusion, to be selfish, to go to war? Is that what we're about? And so are we just fulfilling our nature by doing that? Or is there something else going on? Is our nature basically good? Right? But if that's true, then how do we account for all the negative? To seek happiness, to avoid pain, Buddhism says is actually our most basic impulse. Before thought, most natural and most challenging. It's most natural because if we just cease producing false views, false projections, illusory attachments, then all things, just as they are, naturally abiding, unhindered, and in perfect harmony with all things. It's most challenging because we need to see what is hidden, what is not hidden, actually. We have to let go of what can't be grasped, and we have to realize what can't be encountered. To practice compassion means to enter into the karmic obstructions of oneself and others. You know, it's kind of like, you know, every relationship, right? Every marriage, right? Part of the vow should be, I vow to intertwine my karmic obstructions with yours. Right? And to do that knowingly, skillfully, and as little as possible. Yan Wu in the commentary said, Avalokiteshvara has 1,000 hands and eyes. Great compassion has these hands and eyes. Do you? Do you? And Pai Chang commenting on this is, all the teachings in every sutra returns to yourself. The pointer says, under whom would you study? Who is the master? What is the source of wisdom and compassion? And so, how do we study? How do we use these many hands and eyes? The Master Dogen says, what does the Bodhisattva of great compassion do with these hands and eyes? And he says, there are old Buddhas and there are new Buddhas who have become Buddhas through the power of working on this question. So he's saying, just asking this question, working on this question, is essential. And to work on it means to truly want to know, to let it come from deep within us, to take it in. As Master Dawei said, to put it on the end of your nose, right? Which means it's always in sight, you know, particularly if you have a big nose. And then it's also leading, right? You're also always leading with that question. You know, in other words, don't make it a living inquiry. Don't make it something that we're trying to figure out so we can move on. Live it. You know, it makes me think of the Beyond Fear work that we're doing and this notion of, you know, in addressing, you know, centuries old, you know, ubiquitous and pervasive systemic racism and sexism and forms of othering. That when we take this up consciously, inevitably, you know, the question arises, how do I do this right? What's the right way of doing this? What am I supposed to do so I don't hurt you? What do I need to say or not say so that I don't hurt you? Which is not a wrong question. But it inevitably comes back to, am I getting this right? Am I succeeding at this or am I failing? This paradigm of there's a problem, we have to fix it. There's a question, we have to answer it. And implicit in that is a sense of having done that, then we can just be done with it, get on with it. Like enlightenment itself. You know, once we get enlightened, then you just forget about all this stuff and now just live your happy, enlightened life. And it's really not understanding the nature of life and the path and reality, but the path. That's why the path, this gift that the Buddha gave to us of understanding our practice as a path is so important, because it cuts across and sort of helps to free us from that entrenched view of just trying to get it right. And within that, of course, is be right. Be the right person, don't be the wrong person. It's like climate change, you know, have we solved it yet? Do we have the answer? Have we fixed it? So these questions defeat us. They're defeating questions. They're ruining questions. They're not invitational questions. When Yan Wu says, great compassion has these eyes and hands, do you? That's an invitational question. He knows the answer. The answer is yes, unequivocally. But he wants us to ask that question. Do I? So Daowu said, it's like someone reaching back, groping for a pillow in the night. It's most natural, reaching back for a pillow. It's most challenging in the middle of the night. So what is it to reach back for a pillow in the middle of the night? Such a wonderful response, right? We've all had that experience. Right? In that moment, do you think, I am reaching back for this pillow? I am going to accomplish having reached the pillow. I have accomplished reaching the pillow. Right? Not in the middle of the night. And so this middle of the night is the place that has no address. It is the place that in which we have to leave everything behind to reach. It's the place that is our basic nature. It is why when we come into the Zendo, this training hall, we sit on the seat of the middle of the night rather than at a desk to learn about Buddhist teachings. We rather sit on this seat and embody these teachings. We recognize this lump of red flesh, as Dogen speaks of it, and we use it skillfully. We abide within it, so awake and so at ease that you don't need to think, I am sitting. I am holding this posture. I am on this seat. In other words, we don't have to constantly be managing and maintaining. We can sit in that level of trust. And in that, the self begins to drop away. Master Dogen says, at the moment of dropping away the body-mind, there is a voice that stops all sound. It's not an ordinary voice. He says, understand and resolve that this human body, undivided by self and other, is the entire world of the 10 directions. This is to hear what has never been heard, because directions are all-inclusive and all worlds are alike. Here he's talking about the fundamental nature of all worlds and all directions and this human body, undivided by self and other. At the moment of dropping away body and mind, we realize what is always present, always true. And that is a voice that stops every sound. All directions are in all inclusive, and all worlds are all alike, alike in their basic nature and different in how they appear. You know, this is what's so challenging is how can we get that the world is filled with a multitude of things and they're different. What's difficult to understand is how can that be true, and within that, at that same moment, throughout this, all things have one nature. And so to function freely in this world of differences, because we know that's what we get caught up in, we have to see into their construction. What is it about the way things appear that become the ground of our conflict? The stuff of our greed, the stuff of our stinginess, the stuff of our hatred. Why? If everything abides in its own Dharma state, if everything is just in accord with the nature of things, then why do how things appear to us get us so turned upside down? Is it what they are, or is it how they appear to us? Dogen says, using the hands and eyes is like someone reaching back for the pillow at night. Study the use of hands and eyes in this way. Investigate a nighttime, which is thought of in the daytime, and a nighttime that is experienced in the nighttime. investigate a nighttime that is neither day nor night. Someone may, reaching back for the pillow may not be understood as Avalokiteshvara, using the hands and eyes, but there is no way to escape it. So the night is often used in the teachings as emptiness, as an absolute. The no light, no warmth, no connection, no self, no other, no characteristics, no problems, no joy. And it's not an idea, it's what is directly experienced when the mind stops producing light and dark, happiness and sadness, self and other. In other words, when we come to an absolute rest, when self and other are not divided. This is Zazen. And so Dogen is saying, study that, that dropping away of body and mind, that realization of the self as empty, the reality body. Study it in the day. Study it in the night. Study it at a time that is neither day nor night. And know that reaching back for the pillow may not be understood as an action of Avalokiteshvara, but you cannot escape it. It is our nature. It is who we are. We may not understand it. We may not be seeking it. We may be actively working against it. But we cannot escape it. And it's trying to escape it that is so painful. I was reading a book by Bell Hooks, and she talked about love, compassion, as caring about and being committed to the person's spiritual development. And she said that, you know, that can mean basically just wanting them to, you know, to live this life in the best way possible, in a state of harmony, in a state of peace, in a state of wakefulness. And so compassion, in a very simple way, and she's a practitioner, but she's presenting this in a way that anyone can understand. And so to think about when we use the word love or compassion, I love you, I care about you. So she's saying, what does that actually mean? What should that mean? It means that I care about your spiritual development. In other words, I care about whatever my impact is on you, whatever you're experiencing in this world, as being one that nurtures everything good, everything affirming, everything that is unobstructive in you. And then she says, there can be no love or no compassion between people without justice. And so justice, from the Latin word, means wisdom, being wise, and also equity, quality, all things having one essence. And so we can think of compassion as manifesting justice, wisdom, and equality for the purpose of spiritual development, liberation. So quality is realizing that all creatures have one nature, empty, of anything divisive, of anything different, of anything high or low. And that nature expresses itself dynamically in form and sound and taste and touch and thought and idea. Reaching back in the night is realizing that nature, which is the liberation from then needing to build up, defend, protect, get support for the self. And throughout the history of Buddhism, certainly Mahayana Buddhism, certainly in Zen, compassion has meant reaching back for this pillow in the night, selfless compassion, wisdom manifesting without self. And so in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, the Buddha is asked, how does a bodhisattva practice so they can fulfill the six perfections? How do they practice so that they can fulfill their vows as a bodhisattva? And the Buddha says, here, a bodhisattva, when they give a gift, they don't perceive the gift or the person that they're giving it to or themselves. That's the perfection of giving. When they practice morality, non-harming, they don't think of it as good conduct. They don't think of it as morality. When they're practicing the paramita of patience, they don't think in terms of something that needs to be endured or being patient. In other words, it's just the thing itself. As Dogen says, it's all inclusive. It's the whole universe in the 10 directions. Free of sense of self and other, it's undivided. There's only giving. That's why the practice of Dhanaparamita is to just give, not for the sake of reward, not for the sake of recognition, but just for giving itself. And we see this over and over in the teachings. So Bodhidharma, you know, Bodhidharma is no merit whatsoever. Vimalakirti is saying suffering arises from unreal mental constructions. Hence, nothing can be perceived which is said to be suffering. Kongshi Daoren, one of the masters, the female masters that we chanted this morning, at one point in her life was after she had accomplished herself, had built a bathhouse as part of on the monastery grounds and tending to it. And she wrote a poem. And she said, since there is nothing that exists, what is it that you are bathing? If there's even a speck of dust, from where did it arise? And so this sense that compassion is developing the liberated life of all beings without any sense of self and other. Kongshi said, all you can do, all the holy ones can do is scrub your back. When has a bodhisattva ever illuminated anyone's mind? No one can enlighten you. No one can let go for you. No one can hold on for you. Only we can practice our own mind. Only we can realize our own self-nature. And then she said, yet, even if you erase the distinction between water and the dirt, when you come in here, you still have to bathe. Right? Non-duality. And so in the very moment of selfless giving, right, someone is being affected. Someone's life is being liberated. But who is this someone? From whom would you study? Yanwu says. Dogen says, is the so-called someone merely someone? Is it an ordinary person? Yet not ordinary? If you understand someone as an ordinary person in the Buddha way and do not take it as merely someone, then there is something to study about reaching back for the pillow in the night. If you understand someone as someone, meaning you, as an ordinary person in the way and do not take yourself as merely someone, then there is something to study. An ordinary person in the Buddha way is not merely someone. So we talk about ordinary mind, beginner's mind, that being ordinary is not merely being ordinary, which basically means just keep doing what we've been doing. And yet it's nothing apart from that. How much of our energy goes into trying to be something, to be someone? I was watching this interview with some of these students from Parkland School in Florida who were organizing the march that happened yesterday, the March for Our Lives. And these were the young people who helped organize the whole thing. And they were at Harvard being interviewed. And I thought of them in relationship because they're teenagers. And they were beautiful and brilliant and articulate and powerful and inspiring. And they were silly and awkward and, you know, kids. They were all of that. And the more comfortable they got, the more it felt like they were forgetting where they were, which made it even better, right? Because then they were just being themselves. And that power and that beauty just shined out. It's part of the challenge, really, of practicing, you know, of engaging the teachings, of taking these on and caring about it, you know, is that we can become so, it can become so much of a thing. It can become so self-conscious. It can become precious, or it can become obstructive. And that, you know, that's just sort of the normal part of development, but that it's all moving towards, as one teacher said, losing the shine. Just reaching back for a pillow in the night. But what is this night? Union said, I understand. And Dawu said, how do you understand it? Union said, all over the body, hands and eyes. And Dawu said, you've said a lot there, but you've only said 80%. Union said, how would you say it, elder brother? And Dawu said, throughout the body, or hands and eyes. Dogen says, know that even though the hands and eyes do not hinder each other, how you use them is how you let them be used, and how you use them as they are. How we manifest compassion is not hindered, but how we use them is how we let our compassion be used. How we use this body and mind is how we let it be used. What does that mean? Let it be used, as though there's a force outside of ourselves, as though we just sort of become passive and we'll, you know, things will all work out. How we let them be used. Think about that in terms of Zazen. How you use your Zazen is how you let Zazen use you. So clearly, there's some kind of control that we may have to give up. Oh, no. I'm not sure I want to do that. There's some level of faith that we have to have in something that we can't measure, that we can't know in advance. It's like bodhisattva practice. That's stepping forth, you know, it's sort of easy to step forth when you pretty much know what's going to happen. You go to school, you do the work, you get a degree. You know, you can be reasonably certain of that. But in the realm of compassion, there are no such certainties. And being contingent on those certainties is another defeating condition. We're already defeated. And yet, it's not unwise. We practice to free ourselves. If we don't see that happening in different ways in our life, then we need to really consider, what am I doing? Am I practicing? If we're trying to address suffering and nothing is being affected, then what are we doing? Are we being effective? And so it's not that the bodhisattva is, right, just oblivious to that. It's not that when we go to sit, that there's not a sense of what our practice is, but how do we let Zazen use us? How do we let a situation that we're trying to bring compassion to use us? And what does use mean here? It's not manipulation, it's not control. How do we work with it? How does we let the situation work with us? How do we work together? I mean, it's like listening to these kids. To them, it's so clear. It's just you either decide that you care about human life or you care about guns. Right? What's the problem here? Right? It's not complicated. It's a very clear question, right? In their minds. And they were there. How does it become something other than that? All over the body, throughout the body. So this, of course, is laying ground for all kinds of complications. Who was right? Well, the elder brother must be right, because he's the elder. Right? Isn't that the way it works? That's the way it was when I was growing up. But in the verse, he says, all over the body is right, throughout the body is right. Then why does Dao Wu said, you said a lot, but you've only said 80%. Why only 80%? Again, how effective was our action? 40%, 60%? We're looking for 100%. What's the cutoff point, right, at which we're not going to engage anymore? Right? And yet engaging needs to bring about some change. I mean, can we appreciate the reality and the dilemma of what we call dualities? How do we leap free, right? If we just say, it's just process, just have a good intention, put your heart in the right place, and don't look at anything else, right? Then that's uninformed, it's misguided, it's not affecting change, or maybe not skillful change. But to get completely hung up on, you know, what happens next, means we're already defeated. How do we break free? Dao Wu said, it's like reaching back for a pillow in the middle of the night, something so simple and so challenging. Dogen says, study the true meaning of Dao Wu's words. Even when someone expresses 10 out of 10, if it is without mastery of the way, this is not complete. On the other hand, when what should be presented is presented, when we bring forth what needs to be brought forth, then someone expressing 8 or 9 out of 10 should be regarded as someone who has expressed 10 out of 10. You know, that's why, you know, when you see somebody who is really trying, who is sincere, their whole body and mind, they're willing to put their butt on the line, to commit. Whether they succeed or fail ceases to be the most important thing. That's not what's inspiring. What's inspiring is that willingness, that engagement. These kids told a story about going to see a lot of senators and congresspeople. And they, one of the kid who was talking said, because they were talking about John Lewis and having met him, and the how important that was to them to have met this a true elder, right, of change, who was there, you know, throughout the civil rights movement and was, you know, both, you know, instrumental in helping it to move forward, and also was you know, being beaten down. And here at this very late age in his life, he's still working. And these kids said that when they went to all of these other offices of all these other congresspeople and senators, you know, they'd meet a staff, they'd have to wait, you know, there'd be all these people in the room, you know. They said when they went into John Lewis's office, there was nobody there but him, and he was waiting for them. How do we communicate love? How do we communicate compassion? through what we do. It doesn't have to be a big thing. It just has to be a true thing. I wanted to mention before I close that the week after Seishin, I'm going to be doing Dharma transmission for Zuise. And so, which is essentially done privately. It's really just between teacher and student. And so she'll be involved in that all week. And then on Sunday, as we've done with Hojin and Hogan senseis, there'll be a part that the Sangha can participate in, join in here in the Zendo, so that there's an acknowledgement and of that plum dropping to the ground, ripe. So I wanted to let everybody know, and so if you're able to come and show your love and support for her in a couple weeks on Sunday, that'd be nice. Master Dogen says, bringing forth the entire world of the 10 directions with 100, 1,000, or 10,000 efforts is better than bringing forth nothing. And yet, bringing anything forth with a single effort is extraordinary. Bringing one true thing, one sincere effort, one body and mind forward is extraordinary. How else have we arrived here? How else has this Dharma been transmitted? How else have we held together as a human community in the midst of our delusions and our vexations and our self-centeredness, but for this? Moments of selflessness, moments of letting go, moments of wisdom. And practice is to take those seeds and grow a mighty and great tree and garden. So let's follow the examples of our children who want to live.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.mro.org.